Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we bring you a show about Carmel by the Sea, California.
Yeah, a square mile of some of the most scenic.
With no addresses on the houses.
Yeah, no addresses on the houses. And a gorgeous white sandy beach to go along with it.
And no mail delivery to the post office.
Yeah, and shop until you drop, is what visitors do.
Bring your dogs, because it's the most dog-friendly place I've ever been.
But what about this? If we were going to New York City, of course we would want an introduction by Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Well, in Carmel by the Sea, we got exactly that.
Yeah, you have to mention the fact that we tried to get an ex-mayor, but he was busy.
Clint was busy, but Jason did a fine job, and here he is to give a backdrop to the entire program. Okay, listeners, some of you we know are as old as Peter and Ann, so you know the song by Joni Mitchell, "They Paved Paradise and Made It a Parking Lot." Well, we're in a community which is doing exactly the opposite, in Carmel by the Sea, and the man who's leading the charge is a 36-year-old, young mayor, Jason Burnett. Jason, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us about this wonderful community.
Well, thank you very much for having me. We are really proud of the fact that our community in many ways has not changed over the years. We often recognize that progress for progress sake alone does not make community stronger. You know, we want to have, and we do have, a community that is quite small. You can walk everywhere in town within a half mile or a mile walk. We don't have fast food. We don't have many street lights. We don't have many sidewalks. In fact, there was a documentary film produced that was called Don't Pave Main Street, that was talking about how there really has been an effort over the years to keep true to the vision of Carmel's founders almost 100 years ago.
Now, there were some interesting people 100 years ago, an odd grab bag of people who just came, people who came because they liked the weather, people who came because they thought it was a community where they could write. It was that kind of place. It's a little different today.
Exactly right. Times change, but Carmel was founded really as a artist colony and as a intellectual colony where professors from Stanford would come. They could afford homes. The lots here are all very, very small. The houses here are all very, very small. And back in the day, that meant that they were affordable for a wide diversity of people. Today, not too many people would describe Carmel as affordable housing, but we certainly welcome everyone to come and visit and enjoy what we have, our village in the forest by the sea.
Now, it's a remarkable place in the daytime, but one of the things that's remarkable about it is perhaps its least charming, which is the large number of people who are walking along the streets and the large number of cars on the streets. It seems like this is a better place to come and stay, to experience what it's really like. We had people tell us the same about the Isle of Capri off the coast of Italy, which is packed with tourists during the day, but at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you get your city back. In the case of Carmel, if you're staying, you get the city back.
That's exactly right. You really can't experience Carmel in an hour or an afternoon. You need to be here for a length of time. You need to slow down. You have to explore it on foot. There are these wonderful little courtyards that you'll happen upon, and you'll find a unique store or a unique restaurant or a wine tasting room, and you couldn't have found that on a car. It was simply not accessible. It's only accessible on foot. And you want to take the time to slow down and really experience what Carmel has to offer, which is a slower pace, more in touch with our natural environment. We're right here next to a mile-long sandy beach. Take the time to walk along that beach during the sunset, and then walk a couple short blocks up the hill, and you'll have a choice of 50 restaurants that you can walk to. And then you don't have to hop in a car. Just walk to your inn, spend the night, get up, have a great brunch. That is the sort of pace that we offer, a chance to spend 3 or 4 days without getting in a car. you can do that here in Carmel. But
I asked you before, and I'll give you a chance to respond again, is that it's survey tested that the hottest trend is culinary tourism. Now, you just touched on it. Could you expound a bit on all the new food offerings and also the wine offerings that you have in this region?
Thank you very much for asking that. It's right here in the Central Coast in Monterey County is the salad bowl for the nation. We produce over 50 vegetable crops that are sold throughout the nation, but they're produced right here, and so you cannot get them any fresher than coming and experiencing the food or the fish that are caught right here in Monterey Bay. And there's no better place in my mind to experience that than Carmel by the Sea. We have over 50 wonderful restaurants and chefs that are trying new things every day. We have a farmer's market every Thursday afternoon right here in town. Monterey County actually produces more wine grapes than either Napa or Sonoma, and that is becoming more and more recognized. And we have over a dozen wine tasting shops in town. And really the best way to do wine tasting is, of course, not in a car, because there you have to have a designated driver. Hopefully you'll have a designated driver. Here, you stay in town, and you can walk, do some wine tasting, maybe stop by a restaurant, grab an appetizer, do a little more wine tasting, go out to dinner. That sounds like a pretty nice evening.
True that you need to have a permit to wear high-heeled shoes?
It absolutely is the case that you need a permit to wear high-heeled shoes. In fact, my dad and his wife were out visiting a year ago or so, and my dad decided that he was going to come in and get a permit for his wife. Turns out that you actually have to come in person to get the permit. So he couldn't get it for his wife. So he got himself a permit. I don't think he used it. But you actually have to I don't think they were giving too many tickets to people without permits. But it is one of the little idiosyncrasies, little quirks of Carmel, and what makes Carmel unique. It's like no other place on the planet.
Now, you're filling some fairly famous footsteps in your job. I guess it surprised everybody when movie actor Clint Eastwood decided that he didn't like something about Carmel, so he was going to take it over as mayor. He only served a 2-year term, but it still sort of became a celebrity position. How do you feel about that? You feel like the same degree of celebrity?
Well, no, not that. We don't have a dozen movie cameras coming to every city council meeting. I'll put it that way. But it is actually fun to be mayor of a town where people can name one of our former mayors. There are very few cities in the world where people around the world could name a mayor, and Carmel by the Sea is one of those. And there's been great city leaders over the years and decades. You know, as mayor now, I'm really inheriting some wonderful work from several generations that have seen the same vision for Carmel by the Sea, seen that we don't want to make this the commercialized, and to really celebrate what we do have, and it's an honor to continue that tradition.
Well, we know, because you spoke about this earlier, that you have a goal to bring more people to visit Carmel who are in their 30s like you are than in their, well, we won't say how old we are, but it's been a delight to talk to you. I think you said you'll be running again for mayor in about 6 months. We wish you luck in doing that. I'm sure you'll get elected, and I'm sure you'll do a fine job. And you must keep in touch and tell us about the great things that are going on here.
Wonderful. Well, it's a pleasure talking with both of you. Thank you for coming and enjoying our little town. And I hope that your listeners have a chance to come visit sometime soon.
And such a nice young man. He's elected for a 2-year term. My guess, he's going to be elected for many more 2-year terms until he decides he wants to do something else.
Yeah, could I mention that while we're in the mayor's office, I took the opportunity to get a permit, which is necessary for wearing high-heeled shoes.
There you go.
Anything over 2 inches, More than an inch.
Only on Ocean Avenue, but that's a long story. We don't want to go there. What we need to do is take a break, and then we'll come back to Carmel.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next we're going to be talking to two bright stars.
Yeah, this is interesting. A lot of people will imagine Carmel as a kind of an old people's place, not very trendy, not very modern, not very innovative.
Very charming.
Really, really living on its reputation
and
its charm. But we found two young men who are cooking up a storm. One of them, Justin Cogley, was named one of the top 10 chefs in the country by
Food
and Wine magazine. So he's obviously up to something pretty good, and he sure is. There's no question about that. We had a chance to sample only just a little bit of his cuisine, but it was absolutely wonderful. And a young man who I think is really going somewhere, because he's only 25.
It's
James Anderson.
Yeah. What a career he's already had.
Yeah. And he's doing just wonderful, thoughtful things. Which you just have to listen to. It's really quite admirable.
La bicyclette.
And Justin Cogley is at Aubergine in a hotel called L'Auberge. So we're going to put them back to back, first Justin and then James.
Justin Cogley, why ever did it take me so long to find you here? I did see your photo on the cover of Food and Wine magazine, because you were one of the 10 best new chefs in America. Congratulations on that. And you are now executive chef at Aubergine in Carmel by the Sea. Let's just jump backwards a little bit, because your food and your success is certainly exciting, but your background is fascinating. Tell us about your experience, where you're from, and what your alter ego did.
Well, I'm very excited to talk to you today. Welcome to Carmel. My background, quite interesting one, in fact, and Food and Wine really capitalized on that. And it was interesting, as they don't have many ice skater turned chefs, but I was a touring professional ice skater professionally for 4 years, but skated for about 10 in total, working and traveling and discovering new cuisine and street food in Japan. Especially, I spent almost a year there and went through 14 different cities. So just to see that really inspired me, and how, you know, my work ethic and how I treat product. So basically went to cooking school, long story short, and wanted to work for the best, which at the time, you know, I believe was Charlie Trotter. So I started there as an extern, worked my way up through to Chef de Cuisine the last 2 years I was there. So in total, about 5 years. What was so great is, you know, Matthias Merges was in the kitchen, you know, extremely talented chef, has two very successful restaurants in Chicago now. Many successful chefs have come out of Charlie Trotter's, of course. You know, and he taught, you know, more about simple things like how the dumpsters look or how the street is, and, you know, more about just running a nightly service is more about everything that goes into running a successful restaurant from the moment that people arrive on the curb, which sometimes, you know, I think gets lost a lot today. You know, it's the whole act of service is truly important.
I think it would be safe to say that without Charlie, there would not have been a major food scene in Chicago at all. Did you leave there because you were just ready to leave and this opportunity presented itself?
Actually, I left there. I traveled a lot with the chef the last year, doing demos and wine events. The last one was in the Rheingau, Rheingau Food and Wine Festival in Germany. Came home, and he was going to open this new luxury hotel called the Lysian. Something happened and he backed out, and actually went over there to open that hotel as the executive sous chef, you would say, which was, you know, a new learning experience for me to open a large hotel. It was 188 rooms and 64 private residences, and the owners, one of the main owners at the time, was Alice Waters' cousin. So they really was focused on quality of having house-made preserves in the rooms, ice creams in the rooms and the freezers. It was very food, culinary focused. So, and plus it was amazing. I mean, it's still a luxury, beautiful property. A great impact in Chicago. And then, somehow I stumbled upon this gem out here in, Carmel. I flew out here on a red eye, did a tasting, and flew back and had a contract the next day. So I mean, I fell in love with where I am, so close to the ocean, and really thought that I could go, because I was such a lover of seafood. So I really thought I could capture that here in Carmel.
Well, this is not where you're going to be doing a lot of skating unless you have a secret rink in your kitchen here. Just out of curiosity, did Charlie convince you about his passion for this raw food stuff?
You know, I started there, I believe, in 2005, which is a little bit after the raw took off with a Roxanne Klein and the book. And, you know, as a young extern starting there, I was able to prep a lot of these raw dishes for some photo shoots, which was very fun. And, yes, we did have, every week we'd have 3 to 4 raw menus per week, or sometimes more, that people would still wouldn't request. You know, they still paid full price. You know, so we put a lot of thought into these menus, and throughout the years it started to die down a little bit, but there, every once in a while we still have 2 or 3 requests for a complete raw menu. And in fact, we even had a couple here because they knew that we were able to produce that type of cuisine.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's still at it, actually. Last time we talked, he said we still have to talk about raw food. But anyhow, have you transformed yourself, therefore, into a California chef? I'm looking at a menu here. And, of course, all of your product is California. It's local. But do you feel like you share the same heartbeat with all the native-born Californian chefs?
The one chef, of course, that I personally look up to, obviously, is David Kinch. He's close, the king of coastal cuisine. He was one that, when I first moved out here, I couldn't wait to escape one night to go up and eat there. Yes, we do source a lot. We work a lot with the Monterey Bay Abalone Farm. It's one of our, we believe, our specialties. We bought a 55-gallon tank downstairs so we could have abalone or spot prawns in there at any time so we could pull them out. Actually, there's a couple abalone in there now. We do source from mostly California. We do source some from Asia. We have some Japanese product. Sometimes we pick all our own seaweed ourselves. We pick a lot of the flowers and herbs in the mornings. Both myself and Aaron, the sous chef, we put wetsuits on and go. We're allowed 10 pounds of seaweed per day from certain areas. So we pick a lot of our seaweed and use it for presentation or cook it down or pickle it or preserve it. So every night the guests usually have about 4 to 5 different seaweeds that they eat throughout the meal. If it's made into a cracker, if it's on the abalone dish, or it's here, this eggplant that we steam in seaweed, really try to incorporate where we are.
Our listeners adore detail, lurid details of dishes. Could you just pick a few out? And I mean, your descriptions are fairly simple in a contemporary manner, listing ingredients, but could you just sort of amplify some of your most favorite dishes on your menu? First of all, I guess we should emphasize that you personally favor the tasting menu experience, but could you sort of touch on that, but then do details of some of these dishes?
Absolutely. Actually, when the guests first sit down, they're treated with keeping modern touches around here. Everyone has 3 or 4 snacks as they sit down. So there's we actually have dried some kelp and we make it into a cracker, some tapioca starch, and then there's some beach spinach that we pick that we make a little dipping sauce out of. There's also some right now we have some raw flax crackers that we make with apricot. So these are all little treats before you actually even start your meal, regardless of which menu you choose. Obviously, the tasting menu is a little more involved, but we'll go as fast or slow as diners, I guess, would like. Sure, the first course, we start with lighter and move to heavier, but it says flavors of gazpacho. So basically, what we do is we take all those flavors that are in gazpacho. This is an old Spanish recipe that we came across, maybe 75 years old or so, but we just put our own twist on it. So we have the garlic, we have the onion, we have obviously tomato, the basil, but we blend it all and then hang it for 2 days. There's actually bread in there, stale bread, and then we hang it so it drips slowly over a 2-day period. It produces this clear gazpacho, basically, with all the flavor, but it's actually a clear liquid, and we actually set that with some gelling agents, so it's actually like it looks like you're eating like a clear pudding, but it's actually gazpacho. And then on top, we put a little bit of, we cook mussels, save all their juice, and then freeze it. So it's like a frozen mussel that we put on top, so you eat like this, so you have all these shellfish flavors, but it's actually, pretty interesting. Diver scallop, this is it says cooked in a shell and lemon balm. We actually we source these scallops from the East Coast. Actually, they're larger diver scallops, but we pay a company, so we get 120 per week, 60 on Wednesday and 60 on Saturday, and that's all we get. So we pay extra so they can just ship them here directly, so we don't have to go through another company where they might ship, you know, hundreds of pounds to one place like San Francisco, and then they might sit there for a couple of days. So we have them, since they're dug on the, when the divers bring them up, they're here to our restaurant within 2 days, which is, you know, pretty amazing. We have all the proof of that because we like to just, we clean them, and we cook them in the shell over a, basically a Japanese grill, with a lemon balm, liquid, basically. So it takes 3 minutes. We poach the roe, the red roe, and sake on the side, and then serve that also in the shell. So the shell is served on a bed of seaweed, and then the scallops in there, 3 minutes, you know, it's, you know, perfectly cooked. And then they take the shell off at the table, and so you get those smells of lemon and the seaweed. And so that's that. It's a, you know, it's amazing. We love to, you know, it's just pristine, and we don't like to mess, you know, mess around with it too much. Obviously, the abalone we're very proud of, a king salmon dish, which has got some nice attention. King salmon's from Moss Landing, from our local fishermen. You know, we get, you know, 20 pound up salmon and coastal herbs. So we pick ice plant and, you know, all different, you know, say like seven different herbs from around the area. And we blend that with some shallots that have been roasted and some almonds, and it makes like this beautiful paste. Then we make a sauce out of pineapple weed, which is basically, that we pick out in the valley. It's basically wild chamomile. So we take that and we have it with some dashi and some soy, and that makes a beautiful sauce. So it's king salmon that's slowly cooked in the sous vide method for about 30 minutes, and it basically just gets warm. So it's basically, it looks like it's raw, but it's actually fully cooked or rare.
Well, you certainly have my taste buds excited. I guess I'm wondering if the fact that you were on the cover of Food & Wine magazine and so lauded, if all of a sudden your clientele has changed and you have become a destination restaurant.
Absolutely. That was our goal when I started here, because we only have 9 tables in the restaurant. So basically, you know, besides the weekends, you know, on the weekdays you can have the table pretty much the whole night. We do have, actually they're staying here tonight. We actually have this couple from LA that's joined us 3 times now in the last 2 months that, it, you know, still wants a 20-course menu, you know, 20 courses or so. So it's an extended menu. You know, we've had a lot of people that love food and love cuisine, travel, people on the books for the next couple months that are coming from the East Coast, or, you know, it's all those restaurants that, you know, the 50s best that you dream of. You know, they get restaurant reservations all around the world, and Copenhagen has done so much for the world of cuisine, from Renee to even our San Diego guy, Adam Moss, Matt Orlando, the new place. I mean, you know, people, especially with today's social media, you can find out what's going on around the world at any time. So that's what we're trying.
Well, I really can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to us, and I really figure this is a major discovery on this trip. Thank you so much, Justin. My head is actually reeling. I could not believe that a 25-year-old chef could have accomplished as much as James Anderson has accomplished in his 25 years. I'm going to have him run through just a few of his, and then some of his special projects and menu. He is the chef de cuisine, is it, at La Bicyclette, which, as we all know, is the bicycle which is sitting right outside the window behind my back. Anyhow, welcome to On the Menu, James. Just give us, encapsulate your extensive history.
Okay, well, I'm from Los Angeles. I've been cooking since I was 15 professionally, doing catering. Grandparents on both sides had restaurants growing up. Some of my earliest memories are being in those restaurants. I moved to San Francisco when I was 18, and I went to culinary school at Le Cordon Bleu, there in the center of the city. From there, I worked at Absinthe while I was going to school, so that was my first full-time major restaurant job. Came to Pebble Beach as an intern from my culinary school where I graduated, and I decided to stay for about 4 years. During that time, I opened Bistro Moulin and also in Monterey on Cannery Row with the original chef of Casanova, which was Didier Duterte. From there, I met the Jorises and the original chef of that restaurant, which was John Cox. I since then tier. And my first focus was opening the expansion of La Bicyclette, where I've been focusing ever since then. And it's been about 3.5 years and 1.5 years since I became the chef de cuisine for this restaurant.
Now, the focus of this restaurant, La Bicyclette, is local, sustainable product. Tell us a little bit about that. And also, on top of that, you make your own charcuterie. Just start with that, and then I have 10 more questions.
Well, what I like to say is we need to take the long cuts rather than the shortcuts. For all of my proteins, whether they're local or not, I ensure that it's coming from a well taken care of farm, that there's quality first. The localism is right behind that. Of course, organic and sustainable follow suit. So with my lamb, for instance, from Colorado, or my pork, as much as I can, I will take it from Carmel Valley. There's a lady named Linda. And she has Linda's Tasty Pig in Carmel Valley, and she'll slaughter the hogs for us. We pick the size. They'll be FDA approved and then brought to us the next day. From there, we'll hang it, cut it into the primal cuts, and after about 3 to 4 days, we'll start doing the charcuterie and the curing process. And I'll make everything from head cheese to a boudin noir to our hams. We'll make fresh sausages, bacon, as anything and everything that we can, and we'll utilize from head to toe.
Head to tail.
Yeah, right.
Snout to tail. Yeah. Anyhow, I mean, you're a full service restaurant. You're open for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and all day long. We had pizzas here that were superb. So one of your specialties is pizza. You seem to be in love with mushrooms. What are some of your other passions?
Oh, well, yes, I do love mushrooms, both domestic and wild. One of my biggest focuses is getting greens and color on a plate. And being an appropriate color, so I'll actually go foraging within the local forest here, and I'm fairly well known for that, for picking everything from nasturtiums to there are boletes that grow here. We'll do wild mustard. We'll make vinaigrettes out of all these flowers that I find in the forest, and we'll make these bright green dressings that are emerald green, and they'll hold for 2 to 3 days with this bright shimmer to them. With all of my plates, it's micro seasonal. So I change up to 4 or 5 entrees every Friday, and my focus from Monday to Thursday are on those changes, in addition to maintaining our current menu. We do start at 8 a.m., so our breakfast is very busy. We run through lunch and dinner from 11 to 10 at night, and then we start all over again.
Now, what is it about your French toast that everybody gets so crazy about?
Well, it's a twofold thing. We start with our house-made brioche, so there is that inherent quality from our baking. We use good butters, we use organic, unbleached flours, so the quality from the get-go is much better than you would get off of a Texas toast or a supermarket bread. There's nothing to hold it. There's no fillers in it. The thing that really sets it off is we have a wood-burning oven, which all of the breakfast is based on. So when we have these really brightly spiced brioche that hits the hot pan, goes in the oven, gets a little kiss of smoke from the hickory wood and the oak. It gives you a flavor that you really can't get in any other restaurant. And also, we use only maple for our syrups, and the compotes are all from fresh fruit, so you can't really beat it.
Now, you have seafood on the plate. You love seafood.
I do. One of my backgrounds was actually working in a sushi restaurant while I was at Pebble Beach. So everything from cutting fish to using every fish there is, you know, shellfish and white and red. My focus, like I said, is getting local seafood first. So I have a fisherman that will call me from his boat, and he'll let me know what he's bringing in for that week or for that day. And that's what I select for my menu. So it can be Dungeness crab, it can be sable fish like we have now, it can be halibut, white sea bass. Occasionally we have tunas that run through here, and we'll use those when we can. And I always love getting a good tuna on the plate as well.
Now, you've done all this by 25. What do you do next?
Really, the focus now is concentrating on a style, getting blades and refining certain ideas that that I have now that I do actually have a policy that I abide by and my own structure in the kitchen, it's really refining that and finding ways to teach others and kind of spread the word, really stand on my soapbox, if you will.
Which, of course, leads us to this really fascinating program that you have going with the middle school here. Explain the school yard. What is it called? What kind of program?
So the actual habitat is called the Hilton Bielek, and as something that's a little easier to say, they call it Me Earth. What that is a program that's attached to the Carmel Middle School. Throughout the school year, we will actually focus every 6 weeks. We'll spend a day with the kids. We'll go out. They have about 10 beds there, a couple acres of land, which they provide vegetables for us. And in return, we'll go out there and show the children how to harvest these vegetables, make salads, make your own dishes, make your own salad dressings, and then actually show them how to make pizza and make healthy pizzas out of things that you can select out of your garden. And that's really something that we think is important to the upcoming generation, my own generation, of course, and to anyone that will listen.
Well, it's a brilliant program and a very, very important one, and it takes a lot of dedication. And you don't have any meat, you said you're going to refine dishes, but what about long-term goals?
Obviously, a long-term goal would be to, I suppose the dream is to have my own farm and restaurant within one property. So it would be directly a farm-to-table. And even more than that would be to have my own sustainable farm stand or something to that effect. My family does have farmland south of here, and I'm trying to get them up here so we can start a new chapter in the family name.
Well, James, you certainly thrive on hard work, and you keep yourself pretty busy. I thank you for taking enough time to talk to us, and I loved your wild mushroom pizza.
And we'll be back with some of the traditional side of Carmel right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, you'll find that Peter has done a good many of the interviews because Ann went AWOL for an afternoon or part of an afternoon.
Yeah, we're not going to say where she went.
Yes, we are. We're going to say we went because we were hosted by the Refuge, and it's a sports and fitness center with a spa. And although I didn't do the water therapy from hot to cold and this and that and steam and so forth, I had the most magnificent therapeutic massage by Michelle Kane. So do go there and ask for Michelle. She really knows what she's doing. But anyhow,
in the meantime,
you can introduce all the people you interviewed while I was relaxing at the spa.
Yeah, I mean, in the meantime, Peter was working away on your behalf, of course, always loyal to On the Menu listeners. And first up, Mark Simpson, who's been for 14 years the chef at a restaurant which is, I call it a Carmel institution. And Mark said, no, it's more of a destination. And he'll explain why. But Anton and Michelle is the name of the restaurant. And it's been there about 35 years right in the heart of Carmel. I think Anton and Michelle probably qualifies as an institution here in Carmel. But Chef Mark Simpson, who's been behind the stove for 14 years, doesn't like to use that word. What word do you use instead, Mark?
What word would I use instead? We're a destination. I think that would be the best word to describe us. Not an institution, we're a destination. Whether it's for casual dining, special occasion, a drink before going out to a show, or the anniversary dinner, the birthday dinner, the corporate party, any of those things. I would say a destination is the best way to describe us.
And you'd put yourself on top of the Carmel by the Sea dining heap, no doubt.
Yeah, I've tried to. You know, we're trying to establish ourselves again as being, you know, the place to come to in Carmel. And it means a lot of work on my part, a lot of work on the part of the staff to keep us at that level. And we take great pride in doing that.
Now, that's been change recently, some fairly dramatic change. So, listeners, if you were here 5 years ago, if you were here 10 years ago, if you were here 15 years ago, this is a very different Anton and Michelle, not just in the menu, but also even in the physical surroundings. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, first of all, this past January, we went through a major remodel in the dining room. We remodeled the the entire dining room, and it has a much more casual feel to it, but still has that little bit of elegance, which I think some people really enjoyed with Anton and Michelle's. The feedback has been completely positive. Everybody just loves the changes. And in addition to that, we tried to do things with the food too. Differences in presentation, some of the products we're bringing in, as well as a small plate menu that we do in our bar now, which has really had a positive feedback as well.
Now, one of the things you can do, especially on a beautiful day like today, is you can have lunch by the fountain. Explain a little bit about what that means.
We have a fountain just outside the dining area, which has a beautiful little pool area. There's tables all around where you can sit down and enjoy the sunshine and enjoy a nice casual lunch, whether it's a lunch for two or a larger party, whether you're just meeting friends for drinks, and you can just enjoy yourself out there. We take great pride in it.
You were mentioning before we came on the air that one of the things that's been with Anton and Michelle since the very beginning is what you call the classic dinner for two, which is, I guess, the ultimate Anton and Michelle experience. Talk to us about what that consists of.
This is something that people who've been coming here for 10, 15, 20 years will always remember about Anton and Michelle's. It's our dinner for two. It's done tableside. We start off with a Caesar salad, which the waiter will make the dressing and toss the salad and have great conversation with the customer to make them feel at home, make them feel comfortable, and that will start the dinner off. Second course will be the traditional rack of lamb for two, and it's Australian rack of lamb. It's hand-seared and then finished in the oven, finished with a Provençal crust, and we serve it with a gratin potato, ratatouille, tomato Provençal, and fresh seasonal vegetables. And then when that's done, that'll be taken out tableside, and the waiter will carve that tableside and present it to the guests. Then for their third and final course for dessert, they get a choice of one of three flambé desserts that they can have done, which are also prepared tableside: cherries Jubilee, a bananas Foster, or crepe Suzette.
It sounds really sinful and filled with calories, no doubt, somewhat less than the normal expected consumption of 2,200. How many calories do you think it is, Mark?
Actually, I try not to think about it. I like to tell them we leave the calories at home. If you're on any kind of a diet, we tell you leave the diet at home when you come in for us tonight.
Now, you've got some interesting California ingredients, things that are not on many tables, like abalone and California Kobe. Talk to us a little bit about that and some other ingredients of that kind that perhaps people aren't going to find everywhere.
First off, the red abalone. It's farmed locally on a Davenport in a place called American Abalone. And it's something we've had on the restaurant menu since day one, back in 1980. You don't see too many restaurants that run it. We do a simple preparation of it. When it comes in live. We get it once a week. We clean it ourselves, tenderize it, lightly dusted in egg and flour, quickly grilled on both sides, served with a lemon caper butter sauce, and we use a pickled ginger salad that we serve with it. It can be served as an appetizer or as an entree. Other items, Castorville artichoke, which definitely is known, you know, right here on the Central Coast. We do a nice grilled artichoke, and we serve it with a garlic mint aioli and fresh capers. Another local ingredient you're not going to find too often on too many menus. Just a nice way to start the evening. As we get into the entrees, whenever possible, we try to have local salmon as much as possible out of the Monterey Bay. If we can't get it out of the Monterey Bay, we try to stay sustainable, keeping it on the West Coast, whether it's off the coast of Washington or off the coast of Canada or even as far north as Alaska. So we try to keep the salmon on the Pacific coast. We stay away from the farm-raised stuff. So we try to stay sustainable, which the Monterey Bay Aquarium likes as well.
Now you've got an item on the menu that Ann and Peter absolutely adore, but haven't seen on a restaurant menu in the United States that we can remember, unless it's the perverted farm-raised version, which is barramundi coming all the way from Australia's Gulf of Carpentaria. And you have that coming in, and you really like it, but describe why and how you prepare it.
The reason I like it, it's a unique fish that not everybody's going to have, and it has multiple preparations because it's a firm fish, similar to, I guess you could say, a sea bass. Would be probably the best way to describe it. And it also happens to be Anton, or as we like to call him, Tony, the owner of the restaurant, it's his favorite fish. And he fell in love with it, and he goes, I want it on the menu. I think it's something different and exciting. And that's what we've tried to do. So what we do on our dinner menu, we sear it with a lemon pepper crust, and we serve it with a smoked paprika remoulade and jasmine rice. We also serve it on our lunch menu as a salad. In that one, we do a pistachio crust with feta cheese, and we toss it in a spinach salad with grilled pears. So two wonderful preparations where you can try a fish that you may have never tried before.
Now, let's visit the bar menu for just a second, because tapas is hot. Tapas may be hotter than it necessarily needs to be in California. But your bar menu isn't tapas. It's something quite different. For example, with some spring rolls, but some lamb sliders, some lamb chops. And California red abalone crops up here as well. What are some of the things that you think people like the most on that menu?
Probably first and foremost will be the lamb sliders. I think some people are very familiar with what a slider is, of just a smaller version of, you know, hamburgers. We do ground lamb. It's again a unique item here because not everybody does a lamb slider, and it's very easily paired, served with fresh Roma tomatoes, caramelized onions, a garlic mint aioli, and we serve it with sweet potato fries. In addition to that, another popular item is what we call our seafood grill. And what's neat about that one is you get a little tasting of seafood. You get a prawn, you get a scallop, and you get a little bit of Pacific salmon. So you get three different fish. It's a light item, but it's one of those things you're not sure what you want, but you'd like to try something. You know, the seafood grill is the way to go.
Now we're surrounded by some awesomely sized wine bottles, some of which I noticed are from the Carmel Valley, from a maker called Bernardus. But I'm sure your wine list is much broader than that. Is that an important part of the dining experience at Anton Michel?
Definitely is. We have over 800 bottles of wine on our wine list. California wines, French wines, as well as some rare ones as well. And as you commented from these large bottles, these were all donated by the wineries when we remodeled the restaurant. So it gave us a great avenue to display the wines, and they're also featured on our wine list.
So if I bring a whole lot of friends, the one that I can see just above your head, we could crack that. How many people would that slake the thirst off, do you think?
I'm not sure. It depends on how much you like to drink.
We were at Morton's of Chicago, and one of the wine companies, I forget which it was, decided to cooperate on creating the largest wine bottle that had ever been created to win a Guinness Book of World Records. This isn't quite that size, but it's certainly big enough for a group of six or eight, don't you think?
Oh, definitely for a party of six or eight. And I even have the right dish for that particular bottle, which would be our American Kobe short ribs. It would go really well with that.
I'm going to bring seven friends, and we're going to come back, and we're going to do that. Mark, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This restaurant is right in the middle of Carmel by the Sea, just so the listeners can't miss it. Perhaps you'd like to give them an address and a website.
Anton and Michelle's, we're on Mission Street between Ocean and 7th. We're open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner, including holidays. You can visit us at carmelsbest.com for our website, which includes our restaurant as well as some of our other sister restaurants as well.
Thank you so much. And it's lunchtime. I guess you probably better get back into the kitchen. Otherwise, there'll be some hungry patrons out there. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having the opportunity to come to Anton and Michelle's and hear a little bit more about us. Appreciate it.
We also had a brief word with Fiona Ayers, whose husband's a wonderful chef from Monterey, but she has the pleasure of directing an establishment called the Cypress Inn, which has quite a history associated with the famous performer Doris Day. But there's another tweak to that, something about dogs. Four-legged friends are always welcome at the Cypress Inn, and here's why. If I was a dog, I would absolutely adore the Cypress Inn in Carmel by the Sea. I'm talking to the general manager, Fiona. Why is that, Fiona? Why is it that I would be so happy?
Well, you've arrived at probably the pet-friendliest inn in the entire country. And the reason we became that way was due to our beloved co-owner, Ms. Doris Day, the one and only, who purchased the property in the mid-'80s. And did so with the understanding that that the Cypress Inn would be as welcoming to dogs as we are to their owners. She's very compassionate about animals.
So she's a great animal. How many people knew that?
Well, these days, her foundation, the Doris Day Animal Foundation, is biggest of utmost importance to her, and even more so than the spotlight. She shuns the spotlight from Hollywood and wants all of that attention focused on the welfare of pets instead.
And this is a delightful inn, and Fiona runs it like clockwork. But what is it about the Cypress Inn that makes it feel so comfortable for humans, too?
Well, I think we just enjoy welcoming people as if they're family. We're very humble, and we enjoy sharing the experience with our guests so that we're able to welcome them like family. We get to know them, and it's just such a comfortable space. It's a beautiful space, very inviting, and really the quintessential Carmel experience.
And wonderful, especially when the weather is pleasant, as it was yesterday and is again today. You can dine sitting outside in the courtyard, which we did last evening, and Terry's Lounge sounds like a very casual place, but the cuisine is really serious.
It is. It's a Mediterranean style, as in the hotel, and we're so lucky to be located in what we call the Salad Bowl of America. The Salinas Valley is close by the ocean. Of course, we're right on the ocean, so we've got all the bounty of the land and the sea at our fingertips, and it would be a crime not to utilize that.
And among the treats we had last evening, these were just appetizers. We had some wonderful lamb meatballs and some Dungeness crab. And is that local too?
It is, yes. We get the crab from the Monterey Bay.
For those of you who don't know that, the Monterey Bay is a piece of water that has, among other things on it, a rather singular tree. Isn't Pebble the Lone Star? I caught Fiona there for a second. She didn't know what I was talking about. But it is a rather iconic piece of water. And it's a piece of water that also has a lot going on related to research on aquaculture and an aquarium and all that stuff too.
Yeah, it's home to one of the best aquariums, certainly in the country, if not the world, the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And it's a renowned seafood watch program, ensuring healthy life in the ocean and helping restaurants understand what they can do to prevent overfishing. It's a wonderful program.
But we're in Carmel by the sea, so we're biased. So if you're going to explore Monterey, we would say it's much more satisfactory to do that from Carmel by the sea. Wouldn't you say that?
I couldn't agree more.
You're being so agreeable. I need something controversial to fit into this interview.
Well, if I were to say I was a Raiders fan versus the 49ers, I'd be in big trouble to all my listeners. So.
Okay, well, Fiona's being very reluctant and very shy, which she really isn't at all, but we also know she has to go back to work. So just a last thought for our listeners, Fiona, before you go off and make sure you're taking care of all your guests.
I would say come and check us out. If whether you have your pet or not, you'll certainly get your doggy fix if you're a doggy person. And our website is cypress-inn.com.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And we did enjoy our dinner, from the past appetizers to the we had a gigantic short rib, salmon next to me, and there was a chicken dish as well, and there was a chicken salad, which is Doris Day's own recipe.
Yep, very true. It's her favorite dish on the menu, and we send it to her house about three nights a week.
Once again, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Peter.
And we'll be back with local wine to go with local food right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Robert, you are the one that was dealing with all these wine guys. And
yes.
Do you want to introduce the next two interviews?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, somebody, I can't remember who it was, told me that, in fact, the area around Monterey and Carmel produces more wine in terms of quantity
than
Napa Valley. And certainly within the last 10 years, it's been getting to be much more interesting. People moving in because it's more affordable than Napa and Sonoma and Paso Robles, I guess, and other places. And they're saying, you know, we have good terroir here, we have good weather here, we can grow Pinot Noir, we can grow Chardonnay just like those rascals elsewhere. And they're really putting a lot of effort into making sure they do it the right way. We had a chance to chat with two of the winemakers, Anna Russell from De Tierra, who's in the process of taking over the business founded by her father, and Christopher Whaley from Roth Wines, which is really unusual in that they're already pouring 2011s because they sold all their 2010s and years earlier, which gives you some idea. It must be pretty good. So De Tierra and then Roth Wines, and then it'll be the end of the program. One of the latest attractions of Carmel by the Sea is the fact that vineyards in the vicinity have started to establish tasting rooms right in among all the shops in this charming little town. And we're at De Tierra today talking to Anna Russell, who's in the process of taking over control of the vineyard that her father founded right now. And we're delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you, Anna. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. So I'm just going to tell a little bit about the starting of the winery. We began the winery in 1998. My father planted grapes at our newly built home in Corral de Tierra. It was his goal as a farmer of produce to start a winery, to see organic practices that he puts into practice on produce in the viticulture world. So that was how the winery began, as a small production winery based out of Corral de Tierra. And here we are about 15 years later, and we now have a tasting room in downtown Carmel, newly opened in February. And we are moving through to start producing the wine and distributing outside of California.
Now you would be considered in the Monterey and the Santa Lucia Highlands areas?
Technically, yes, we are Monterey Appellation, which are any of the AVA that are outside of the Santa Lucia Highlands, Hames Valley, or any of the more well-known AVA in the area. So we have two main vineyards, the Sargenti, which is just north of the Santa Lucia Highlands on River Road, and the Corral de Tierra vineyard called the Russell Estate Vineyard, which is technically Monterey AVA.
And that's a property that you can visit by arrangement?
Yes, the Corral de Tierra Russell Estate Vineyard is our home vineyard. We host a lot of events out there, dinners, new release parties, and we're starting a new practice now that we have the tasting room up and running of bringing guests out to the winery to actually see the viticulture in action and to taste the wines where they're made.
Talk us through the portfolio of wines, especially the ones that you think are the most unusual.
We particularly focus on sustainably grown and organically farmed wines. So in general, that's what we're most proud of, is the sustainable aspect. The specific varietals that we make that are most well known would be our Syrah, which is a South County Arroyo Seco Syrah. So rocky soil, really inky Syrah with a lot of bold flavors to it. We also make a Pinot Noir and a Chardonnay at our Russell Estate, which are all organic, all sustainable, and we focus on minimalistic strategy in the winery. So they have a lot of minerality. They really show the terroir specific.
So you let the grapes sort of speak for themselves.
Exactly. And that's kind of, although the name of our winery comes from the road, Corral de Tierra, that we started our vineyard on, the focus has always been on organics and minimalistic practices in the winery and single vineyard terroir-based wines. And another one of those is the new Cab Franc that we planted at our home vineyard, which is going to be a very small production Cab Franc, which is unusual for the area.
And will you blend with that, or will you make a Loire-style Cabernet Franc?
We're actually just going to make single varietal Cabernet Franc. So we have made in the past some Cab blends, but we are trying to move towards single vineyard, single varietal, which really expresses terroir more specifically.
Interestingly, while we've been here, we've been tasting wines that are 2010, almost 2011 vintage. I'm looking behind you at the chalkboard, and I see that you have a new release of Estate Merlot from 2008. And a Monterey Pinot Noir from 2008. So are you doing something different in terms of holding your wine in intermediate storage, or are you bottling and then keeping off the market until you think they're ready?
That's exactly the goal. Is the goal specifically with the reds? We're a little bit less focused on that element for the whites. The oak aged Chardonnays, though, we do like to hold them back a little bit so that they have time for the oak to integrate. But that's one of the issues that we see in our winemaker, Zach Lawrence, focuses on, is that we see so many wines from Monterey that are put into bottle and released before they've really had time to age in bottle and to integrate and to really be showing at their best. And so for us, our Pinots, our Merlots, I mean, that type of fruit, there's only 5% of the wineries in California that have an estate-grown wine that they actually cultivate from start to finish, and even less so that are organic. So for us, there's really, the fruit is priceless, the wine is priceless, and it doesn't make sense to release it when it's not ready yet, and you really want it to be showing its best. So that's the goal with the 2008 that we are showing in our tasting room now.
Now you're going off, you've grown up under your father's tutelage, I guess, so far, but you are going to school very soon to learn a little bit more.
Yes, I spent a lot of time growing. I mean, I grew up watching my dad pretty much grow everything that you can grow, and he has a green thumb. I mean, you can see, well, you guys can't see because you're not in the tasting room, but we even integrate that element into the tasting room. We have tons of plants inside and outside. For me, I learned from him quite a bit, but my next goal is I'm going to the Davis Extension Program for small wineries and viticulture to learn a little bit more about the actual production. I spend a lot of time in the winery, but it's the chemistry and the newer practices, the cutting edge stuff that really will make the difference in the future, especially with organics and sustainability. So that's what I want to focus on.
Now, you're not going quite as far as biodynamic, though.
Biodynamic farming is a personal choice of the winery. For us, we don't think going that far makes sense. We do use the sustainability and practice certification, or SIP certification, that we received 2 years ago is organics, it's sustainability, it incorporates certain elements of biodynamics, but those that we find the most useful. So that was the goal. I mean, on the vineyard, we have owl hutches. We planted a lot of different diverse horticulture around the area. So the goal is to facilitate natural biodynamic practices without going all the way to biodynamic.
If I were to fast forward 10 years from today, how would the Tierra be different?
Specifically, we want to move towards 100% organic farming. The goal of planting the estate vineyard that way was because we consistently see organic farming producing better quality fruit. So it's both makes sense for the business, and it also makes sense in terms of conservation, obviously, as well. And, that was one of the reasons that my father actually started the winery, was because he moved most of his produce production to organics and saw a drastic change in the quality of the product. And you think about it, produce is only 30 days of growing cycle for the most part, and a wine can be on the vine for 6 months, and so that, or grapes can be on the vine for 6 months. And so that's the goal, is to move towards 100% organic, maintain the sustainability, but expand it to be part of our business practices, not just our farming.
Now, side by side, like a lot of wineries and vineyards in Europe, especially in Italy and in Spain, you're growing side by side, you're growing olives.
Yes, that was another goal of my father's when he started the winery, was to see, those two products grow side by side in many places in the world, and they grow well, and to see what Tuscan varietals. We make an organic olive oil that's a blend of 6 different Tuscan grapes, olives, and that was a goal of his, and it's turned out well. We only make about 100 to 200 cases of it each year, so it's really small production, and as we were talking about earlier, it very much depends on the year and kind of the cyclical element of olive growing. But it's a nice product for us to have, and it pairs very well with wine.
Now, if you don't have the opportunity to come to Carmel by the Sea or go to the vineyard, can you order the wines and the olive oil online? And if so, give us the website.
Yes, you can order everything online. Our website is www.detierra.com, which is spelled DETIERRA.com. You can buy anything through the website that we produce, and you can also sign up for our wine club if you're interested.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I feel sure we're going to hear more about your vineyard as this area seems to be finally getting some attention, and I'm sure you're pleased with that.
Yes, it's there was a recent article in the Wine Enthusiast magazine naming us one of the top 10 wine regions in the world, which was a huge thing for Monterey, and it put us on the map and made many people in the States and outside of the States, for that matter, to realize that this area has so much more to offer than just wine. You know, culinary, the sites, the, you know, everything that Salinas Valley and Monterey has to offer. And so we're pretty excited about it. It's bringing people from many different areas, and that's obviously good for business.
Thank you very much, Anna, and I'm going to raise my glass. You don't have one in your hand. Oh, yes, you do. Okay, so here we go. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Peter, and we hope to see many of you in the tasting room.
I think the first question I'm going to ask Chris Whaley, and he doesn't know this, is why a winery would called Wrath?
Well, usually this question is reserved for the end of the conversation, but we can start with that. The word Wrath came from a Led Zeppelin song, Going to California. And in the second verse, the first line, the line goes, "It seems the wrath of the gods got a punch in the nose and it started to flow." Michael Thomas, who's the owner and came up with the name, literally was tooling down the highway in his truck, just outside of the winery, and heard the song come on and was listening to the lyrics, and when he heard the word wrath, except that the English, Jimmy Page would have pronounced it wrath, he still recognized it for what it is, and he said, "That's it. That's the name of the winery."
I'm still not sure I understand it. It seems extraordinarily enigmatic, but I'm guessing that Dr. Michael Thomas, who's a professor, I think you told me, Chris, at the University of Texas at Austin, but who spends his summers digging up Italy, trying to find out more about the history of wine, I suppose it's not surprising that he would have a slightly mysterious name for a vineyard.
Mysterious, I don't think so, but enigmatic, the word that you used, I think is the right word. It is surprising how many other wineries in California have names that are derived from rock songs or rock groups. Case in point, Ed Kurtzman, who was the winemaker for Roar for a long time, who is no longer with him, he has his own project called August West. August West is the name of a character in a Grateful Dead song, so it's not unusual to have that as part of your zeitgeist.
Now, this Wrath is an interesting winery. We're here in their tasting room. In a small but charming mall in Carmel by the Sea. And Chris, you were telling me something unusual. Your wine is so popular that you're almost sold out even before the year begins. How does this happen?
Well, Peter, it's a good problem to have. And we're quite happy about that. We produce a total of 4,500 cases, 21 bottlings. So divide the 21 into the 45. It's everything's 250 cases or under, and in some instances as little as 68 cases of wine. Something that's going to be coming out here in a couple of weeks, has we made 68 cases. We will be sold out really within a couple of weeks, and our allocation here at the winery will be very little. So we work with Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Syrah. We make a Seigneur, a rosé of Pinot Noir. Last year we made 150 cases of it. We sold out within 4 or 5 days of that particular wine. We make a couple of dessert wines as well. Those go slower. Everybody professes to enjoy dessert wines, but when it comes down to purchasing, it's not always the case. So small production, good problem for us to be out. We have a name and a label that is very, very recognizable. The name Wrath looks great on a t-shirt, looks great on a hat, gives an edge to everything. Anybody wearing it, even Peter, would look like he's got some serious edge.
The story is mostly about Burgundy, I think. It's mostly about Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, two grapes which are grown widely in the United States, but not necessarily grown all that well. What makes Wrath different?
Well, several things. First of all, we're in this really beautiful area, just about an hour east and south of Carmel by the Sea is the Salinas Valley and our winery. We have 72 acres. It's an area that took a long time to figure out that Pinot Noir and Chardonnay needed to be planted there. Originally, a lot of people had planted because it was what was asked for. People had planted Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and other warm weather grapes, Zinfandel. These grapes don't work in our area. We're a region one, relatively cool, 72 degrees year-round temperature. Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot are much more suited to Napa Valley, parts of Sonoma, and so on and so on. So Pinot Noir being a difficult grape to grow, the yields are smaller, whereas it's not unusual to get 5 or 6 tons per acre of Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot up in Napa. Even if you drop a little fruit, you still end up with that much tonnage. Pinot and Chardonnay in our area, we're lucky if we get 2.5 tons. We're lucky if we get that much. There are some years in some of the vineyards, not unusual to get 1.5 tons or 1.75 tons per acre. So that obviously raises the value of the wine, assuming that you have good soil, and we have excellent soil for it. That's the one big reason that you can call Pinot Noir the heartbreak grape, just because when it's not done well, you think you've done everything correctly in the vintage, and it turns out lousy, and you flush it all down. But when you do it well, it makes you proud because it's really quite an accomplishment.
Now, the funny part about it is that you're growing in a region which is very rich agriculturally, with avocados, lemons, lettuce, artichokes, prickly pears among the crops that you mentioned in the Salinas Valley. But you want a different kind of soil than that in order for the grapes to flourish the way you want them to.
That's right. Some of the reason that some of the vineyards are in our area were planted is just by stumbling upon the fact that we have really good soil. So we have decomposed granite, we have a little bit of sand, very little organic matter. All of this drives minerality into the vines. There's a truism that if you stress the vine, just like humans, if you stress it a little bit, you'll get the best out of it. A vine, if you took a vine and you planted it in, say, Nebraska, where I'm from, take away the humidity, obviously, because that'll kill the vine. But if it were dry, the vines would be prolific, but you wouldn't end up with anything of value. You need stress in order to get the best.
That leads me to an interesting question. I haven't asked other winemakers here, but do you irrigate? There's a school of thought that says irrigating makes wines flabby because the roots don't have to struggle. What's your position on that?
We do some irrigation. We do some dry farming. And the irrigation that we do a little bit of overhead with our Sauvignon Blanc, which is what our vineyard is primarily planted to. We make more Sauvignon Blanc than any of the other bottlings. So we do some overhead, and we do the Sauvignon Blanc for a very specific reason, because we pick twice, once underripe, once overripe, and so the overhead sprinklers help us with that. The drip is typically done on the other grapes, and just in a dry year we'll use it. Otherwise we don't. Everything else is dry farmed.
Now, how do people find out more and get connected with Rath? You're obviously going to need to do that if you're going to want to get some, and you don't have the opportunity to come to Carmel by the sea to the tasting room, which presumably you always have a supply. But how can people get on your list? Do you fulfill via online ordering, all that stuff?
That's right, Peter. We do actually a lot of online ordering. It all comes out of the winery. Michelle, my tasting room assistant manager, fulfills all of those. It's best to go online to find what we have available or not. Sometimes in the tasting room, we have some bottlings that you won't find online. Like this year, we produced a little bit of Grenache and a little bit of Muscat Blanc, dry Muscat, and it is so good. Dry, perfumed, you know, just talking about it makes me want to open up another bottle of it. So yes, online is the best. You'll get the best choice, or you can give us a call and we can tell you over the phone what we have available. Michelle or myself or any of the other employees can help you with that.
And the website is?
Rath Wines, Rath, W-R-A-T-H, wines, plural, .com. So when you get onto the website, you'll be treated to a little bit of a paragraph written by Michael Thomas, the owner, and he has some references to Greek and or Roman mythology, even rock and roll on there. And then once you get past that, then you get into the wines that we currently produce.
And if you want to know more about Dr. Thomas's excavations in Italy, one going on not too far from the city of Pompeii, I'm guessing that a Google is probably all that's required. Dr. Michael Thomas.
That's correct. There's only one, and it's him, and he's very well known in the world of archaeology. He has many students over the years that have trekked to Italy with him, And as I understand, he's quite the lecturer. He can go on for hours.
But I'm sure you could too. But we also know you have an appointment, and we have an appointment. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today,
Peter. Thank you very much, and feel free to come by anytime. And anybody out there, we have two beautiful tasting rooms: one at the winery, one in Carmel by the sea. And we always have some goodies that some extra goodies that you won't find online.
So there you have it. Clint Eastwood moved there for a reason. Jason Burnett is mayor for a reason. Lots and lots of people live there because they love it there. And I think you love it if you visit, because there's a lot to do, both ancient and modern, both outdoors and indoors. So
magnificent, yeah, big, yeah, stately homes.
Yeah, go say those guys from Carmel by the Sea sometime soon. And we're glad we had the chance to bring it to you today. And until next week, we'll say once again, as we usually do,
bye-bye.